Welcome back to the New Space Vision podcast, sponsored by LiveVIO, where we discuss new space technology, finance, and innovation with executives, founders, and more exciting people from the startup and new space ecosystem. I'm Daniel Seidel.
And I'm Sam Shivara, and together we are the founders of the Earth observation company LiveVIO and New Space Vision. Today we are very excited to welcome Philip, co-founder and CTO of VidaPlace, which monitors infrastructure with a focus on impact investments. Welcome.
Glad to be here. Thank you very much.
So, Philip, we always start the podcast off with a couple of questions around the person which we're interviewing to just like give the audience an understanding of who we're talking to. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about yourself and maybe what you've studied and have been doing before working and founding VidaPlace.
Yeah, sure. My pleasure. And yeah, first of all, just want to say thank you again very much for having me on the podcast. I've been listening to the podcast, the previous episodes for quite some time. So super excited to be here today. So, so my background, I think I can say what's always been kind of like super exciting to me is, this kind of like move that we have to make from kind of like a fossil fuel based economy onto like a fully renewable based, like, kind of like energy infrastructure. So, this kind of like key interest really goes throughout my career so far. Started very, very early. I remember, buying with my kind of the high school pocket money that I had, buying like two big like solar panels, much to the dismay of my parents. Always kind of trying to figure out, you know, like what could be the next, the kind of like the energy future that we really need. Because to me, it's really all about kind of the more cheap, abundant energy we have, the more exciting things we can do in society, right? From the economy as a whole, but also like doing the new exciting stuff like spaceflight, for example. So this has really always been kind of like the key motivation that I've had. This led me to study physics. So I was born and raised in Switzerland and studied physics there as well, with a very much kind of strong focus on applications. Was doing laser physics for a while, material science as well, and also worked into university spin-offs before I joined VIDA. That these two spin-offs were again very much focused on hardware. On laser physics as well. And after doing that for a few years, I moved to Germany, where I met my two co-founders, Nabin and Tobias. And together we joined forces and co-founded VIDA together.
That's super exciting. So you did laser physics. So you are now in a new space podcast. But you're not building the next LiDAR constellation from space, right? You're actually a software company. So you didn't have a background in Earth observation, what I now understood. What about your co-founders? Did they had this background?
So interestingly enough, not like a hardcore background in that, no. So my co-founder and CEO, Tobias, was previously working in India for many, many years. And he was building one of the largest solar power consultancies just at the time where the Indian kind of solar market took off. And my other co-founder, Nabin, he has a very strong background in power engineering and kind of like enterprise software. So he was working previously at large companies in India before then also moving over to Munich. So interestingly enough, we didn't have like that very strong or like a direct like Earth observation background. We really very strongly came from the application side. So we just essentially found that treasure trove of like Earth observation data and realized, okay, this is exactly what we needed to kind of like solve the issues that we were facing and addressing VIDA.
So you have observed global problems in the energy supply or energy industry or opportunities, right? Problems and opportunities. Maybe can you tell us a bit why then the geospatial part was the one you guys focused on? Because with that background, you know, you could do so many other things in that industry, but why geospatial?
Sure. So that is really very much linked to the problem that we're solving with VIDA. So actually we came together in Munich at the time at a previous company called TFE Energy. And there we were really kind of working more as a consulting company across the globe and trying to help governments and kind of like some of the large development agencies like the World Bank on kind of like essentially building energy infrastructure in some of the most underserved rural areas in the world. So we've worked across, you know, in very remote places. We've worked in Papua New Guinea, for example, in Myanmar, India as well. And very much so, very often in these projects, the key problem that we saw was that you really had to get on the ground, visiting these like villages to even get the most basic information, like where are these villages in the first place? Are there people living there? How easy is it to access these places? And right around that time, we got actually a very generous grant from the European Space Agency under their business applications program. With the idea being that, you know, we could use satellite imagery in order to kind of, in a much more scalable way, find out some basic information about this kind of like underserved, unelectrified population. Because you can obviously scan the whole country and understand where do people live? Is there already some existing energy infrastructure in these places? And where should like governments ideally focus on? So it doesn't give you obviously like very in-depth kind of like information about a place, but you can get it, cover some of these basics. And this is actually one of the first products that we rolled out with Vida, a product which we still kind of is very active, actively used in more than 20 countries at the moment. So this is kind of like where that Earth observation angle came in. So really just to kind of like solve a very specific problem.
Super cool. So you already gave us a couple of nuggets about what Vida has been doing, but like maybe tell us as an overview, what is Vida Place doing? What's your company vision? I'm sure you have given this pitch hundreds of times. So maybe you could summarize a little bit about Vida Place.
Yeah, sure. So again, as I said, like the first 2 years actually of when we started Vida, really what we've been all about is this kind of like solving energy access. So helping the kind of countries to really connect the last person to a reliable, renewable energy grid. This has been kind of like the initial kind of like really vision. And now these days we're actually switching a bit. And nowadays we're really focusing very, very heavily on the essentially renewable infrastructure globally. Because, and that's my personal take as well, like if we are to achieve a really sustainable future, in many ways, the technologies exist today, right? As compared to say 10 years ago, we're now, solar power plants are really mature. We're on the way to kind of like solve the battery problems as well. Wind parks, hydro, et cetera. These are really mature technologies. And I think at this point, it's really about essentially the rollout of these technologies. Yeah. And like adoption. This is now the key thing that we really want to supercharge. And we really know this, like we don't have a lot of time, right? Because we have to make this switch really, really quickly in order also to kind of like counteract the effects of climate change. So this is really why we realized, okay, there's something stuck in the kind of like the global rollout of these technologies. And this is really where we're focusing very heavily today, and specifically on actually the people who invest into this infrastructure.
Yeah.
So there's obviously very large banks, there's very large also public donors, also smaller companies, funds, etc., who want to invest into these sustainable infrastructure projects, but very often don't actually can't really do proper due diligence and proper monitoring, simply because often the data is not available or the transparency is just not there. So this is really what we want to do with Vida, being kind of like a geospatial software tool that kind of puts these pieces of infrastructure on the map and really kind of like unlocks this or kind of like supercharges this whole investment process, really from selecting the sites to sealing the deal to then also monitoring and reporting. So this is really where we're going towards these days, and it directly comes from our vast experience now working in all of these kind of like developing countries in very remote places, where ultimately it's the same thing, right? It's kind of a government or public finance institution. They want to build infrastructure in these villages, and there you have data scarcity and very little transparency. So we're kind of like solving the same issue, but now we're really going much more global.
Yeah, and full stake, and what I understand also like impact evaluation, right? Monitoring the impact of the investment is a big thing. At least on your website, it's quite prominent. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. I just came from a global impact investment forum here in London, and like it's really kind of this is huge at the moment. So everybody's talking about it. Yeah, it comes with like totally new requirements in terms of like what data do you have to gather, how do you even assess the risk, right, under this ESG umbrella? What do kind of investors have to look for? These are largely unanswered questions that we wanna answer with Vida.
And you've already mentioned big banks, big corporates. What are your typical customers today?
So at the moment we've been working with some of the largest, very large kind of like obviously likes of the World Bank. We've worked very closely with the IFC. We've worked with similar kind of like very large development banks in Europe as well. And they've now kind of running pilots with some of these also more European, essentially infrastructure funds.
Nice. And we have also seen that in the early days, you got also support from the European Space Agency, right? You just mentioned, using satellite data to map it.
Mm-hmm.
You also very often say geospatial data. Because it's not only remote sensing data, right? So what kind of data sets are you using and how much is it really satellite data versus other data sets?
Yeah, this is a very good question. So I would want to say we're very opportunistic as like a downstream kind of like company, right? To just kind of take, use whatever is there, and typically following the approach that that we want to buy ideally already kind of processed data sets, or really geospatial data sets, instead of having to go all the way back to the imagery, because obviously that comes with a lot of engineering effort to build the pipelines, to do validations, etc. So we have kind of like a mix. So for example, we very heavily use nightlight imagery, right, from the NASA missions, where we also have a kind of full processing pipeline ourselves in house. For example, to really understand like the electrification. The electrification status of like remote villages. We've been using Sentinel to imagery quite heavily, sometimes to understand like, you know, how a village has grown over time. We've used it, but to be honest, more in like pilot projects, also like commercial, very high resolution imagery to really kind of like monitor individual kind of like smaller assets. Especially in the context of like the developing world, there's quite a few, and that's actually a really good development. There are a lot of publicly available data sets that can be very useful that we have access to, such as say building footprints, right? Google has opened up some of these products, and they're often just a snapshot in time, but for us, that's very often a great starting point. So, and that's obviously like one of the main kind of like developments we see in the sector is this emergence of more and more of these already kind of like processed kind of like data sets that are available.
That's super cool. That confirms a bit also like what Sven and I always think about, like who will build end user applications. Is it the satellite operator or is it other companies? And what's very interesting here is we have a company with you guys now focusing on the energy in the industry. Not coming from Earth observation, so you don't care where the data is coming from, right? You mix a lot
Correct.
Of different data sets at the end to solve the problem. And you also, you know, you don't win a prize for doing everything on your own, right? So it's just, we need to solve the problem. So that's pretty cool.
Exactly.
You said you worked with nighttime imagery. You're the first one also in this podcast who said that. How was that experience? And I'm always asking myself, because with optical data you always have the clouds, how do you detect clouds at a nighttime image?
That's actually a good question. Yeah, I mean, we are, so this is this NASA VIRS, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, data set. I think I'm not sure, quite sure how old the mission is. I think it's been around for some time. But yeah, I think there's the products that are offered are kind of like already, I think for our purposes at least, that they're already well post-processed in terms of, I think, removing kind of like reflections that you obviously have at night, right? There you have a few challenges like reflections of the moonlight, for example. But then also at the same time for us specifically, what's really been helping there is to kind of like aggregate many, many dates, as opposed to kind of like using individual kind of like snapshots.
That makes sense.
Because for us also, because we're looking at dynamics that change, you know, over the course of months to years. So very often, like in our processing pipeline, we can just kind of, you know, sum it up over a year, and then we have a pretty good mean.
And in these countries also, Google Maps and OpenStreetMap is not sufficient to get the level of information, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So maybe because like there are so interesting case studies on your website, maybe we make it very practical. Mm-hmm. Maybe can you walk us through and just an example project of yours? Like from end to finish, like how would that work? Yeah. Because exactly, maybe as an additional thing to that, what you've just said earlier is that are not only working on the identification of errors where investments need to happen and the implementation of these investments, but you also said that you would introduce field data and collected field data. So there's a lot of complexity to it. And I think to make it most practical, maybe you can just walk us through an example project.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So again, there's the... There's, and to your point, actually, we are very much focused also in kind of like our software engineering practice on kind of like adoption of like end users to kind of inject their own, kind of like bring their own data into the platform, which is in a very kind of a challenge in its own right. I can give you an example of a project that we've currently had in the DRC in Congo, where essentially together with the government and the IFC, so that's the International Finance Corporation, we were essentially working together to really understand what's the kind of potential to build solar mini grids, kind of like renewable mini grids across the country. And it's really important to note that we don't just, again, there's only kind of like the first phase, which is kind of to actually identify kind of like all the universe of potential sites. So it is really, for example, could be a full country scan, understanding, okay, where are these villages, what's their electrification status. We extract a bunch of other kind of like geospatial or kind of like a bunch of other properties for each village from how it's changed over time to population statistics, access to social infrastructure, etc. So this is typically what we do in the first phase. And then actually that is, we're a SaaS platform. So this is then essentially also handed over to ultimately the client. In this case, it would be the government that would then kind of like take it forward, because it's really thought of as like a platform to kind of like really not just go from planning, but really also go from planning to kind of, proper feasibility studies to roll out to monitoring. So how this happens then is that typically we say the government, the Department of Energy, for example, would take this over. They would often do on-ground surveys. They collect the data on the ground. They kind of inject that back into the platform. They really work through the platform to then gather more data about which places to invest in. And they, as such, then kind of like enrich the geospatial data sets that we have, or kind of geospatial information with proper on-ground information. And then, essentially, this is often, it is where in certain countries we're now in the process of doing that. The platform is then really also used to kind of to share this data with, for example, the private sector, for example, the companies who actually then go out and build the power infrastructure in these villages, and then report back through the platform as well. So this is really becoming like an end-to-end kind of tool to kind of plan and then roll out and then ultimately also monitor. So this is kind of like the energy sector, but then on the kind of like the infrastructure, kind of like the new product we're launching soon for infrastructure investors is really kind of also like this phase of like first exploring kind of like potential new sites that an investor would like to invest into, looking at climate risk, looking at environmental risks, and then essentially building a portfolio. And once you build that portfolio and the sites are there, we enable kind of like continuous monitoring of your whole portfolio, meaning that the investee, as in like whoever has built the infrastructure, can report back through the platform with like key performance indicators that you would then, for example, need to continuously assess the performance of your portfolio, but also enable reporting, which is increasingly becoming super important, right? In the all the kind of like new ESG reporting standards that are popping up.
Yeah, now we are getting really, really Zazi, right? So now it's getting more into software as a service when you say recurring, et cetera.
Yeah.
Like Sven and I discussed it before that you started more in projects, right, for these big organizations, and it's very individual.
Yes.
So I try to structure my thoughts, because the mapping of these features is a one-off thing, right? And also this validation is a one-off thing. But you then position your software and the access as a service. So does it mean that the analytics and the data you do is just an entry, but at the end, you know, they use your tool on a daily basis, independent of how often you update the maps? Is that the thing? Or?
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly true. Yeah. So certain maps, obviously, certain layers get updated more frequently than others. Some of them are, as you mentioned, can be one-offs. But then it's really very strongly about kind of the actual work or the data that they that our end users bring with them, be that survey data, be that actual performance data from these assets, and this gets put back into the platform.
So basically, the update frequency of the user data is sub daily, right? So every day they interact with it. And what about the remote sensing data? What is there typically like the frequency you update data?
So at the moment, again, like depends. So if you have customers who really need to know, you know, there's been cases where, for example, the infrastructure's investor kind of want to look at, you know, is basic questions often like, is the asset still there, or can like is construction over, or can has this kind of, say a solar park has been further expanded. Right, in which case you just have to get kind of like more on-demand or very high-resolution imagery to kind of understand, okay, has this process been completed? In which case, this can be really, sometimes can be weekly, can be monthly updates as well. Whereas for other ones, obviously, kind of things that don't change as quickly, be that, for example, if we're looking at growth of villages over time or growth of kind of like cities over time, this can be like half yearly to yearly, for example. So. Same with what we do with the nightlight imagery. Typically there we do like yearly updates, because that's just kind of, it's fun to look at it like from week to week, but really there's often not that much happening.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. And of course, when you do these large scale activities, but somehow the mapping case is very individual. It's not fully automated, right? So you have a semi automation, I assume. Can you tell us a bit about this, and also what are the challenges? Like, I'd like you, you know, we have the same challenges with automating geospatial analytics. Not so easy. What is your experience there?
No, definitely. Yeah, I mean, we've tried, we've invested quite a bit of time into this. We have obviously a lot of kind of like automated pipelines that run from again, in the case of, to make it very concrete, of say identifying these villages that can be kind of run automatically, but will always require some human validation. And also what's really important, obviously, is that the data that whatever you provide your end customers with has to be something they can trust in. So very often when it's about really kind of like a hardcore, say, mapping exercise, it's also really important to kind of like take the customers along and actually build capacity with our end users in the process. Of like understanding, okay, look, this is kind of what the technology can do. These might be some of the drawbacks and the strengths and weaknesses of it. So it can go as far as saying that that in certain places, when we map, say, maps or villages or buildings or whatever, that we say, look, this is just the best guess currently, and this might have to be updated in the future, or it can kind of be amended directly through the platform as well. So. There's a huge push to kind of to automate as much as we can, but I think it's still to this state, it's that there's a lot of we have a pretty big data science team, or kind of like data processing team as well, and that I don't think this will go away anytime soon.
So maybe a question regarding that, because we are thinking about this also extensively. Obviously, generative AI helps with sorting data and sorting through data. And what you've described is a lot of data coming in from customers with different formats, different kind of naming, wording, whatever. And we feel the struggle with our customer base sometimes about like what's really structured data. So as the CTO of VidaPlace, do you see that there's a big potential with that? For your types of applications?
You mean, sorry, now specifically with like the latest AI tools or?
Exactly, the latest AI tools to help you with pre-processing data and making the most out of it.
Yeah, I mean, great question. And I do think so. Especially like everything in finance, obviously, is still based on Excel, right? It's column data at the end of the day. And so I think I've seen some pretty funky kind of examples of kind of doing kind of like data, just input validation based on also the largest, like these latest large language models, which I think it can be super exciting and almost like it could be a kind of pre-processing step for any data that's being fed also into our platform. So I could see how this can become some, we'll just kind of make it easier to do some sanity checks of the data. But again, like this is all early days, obviously. Yeah. I don't see the kind of, I still think, and we also work a lot on that, just having solid data models and kind of being sometimes also a bit strict about the input format that of like, of how we need the data to be in the platform and enforcing this as well. And building that kind of, that, the discipline as well of like how user data ends up in the platform. I don't think that goes away anytime soon.
Yeah.
Maybe at some point it could be fully unstructured, but I think we might still be a bit away from that.
This podcast is sponsored by LiveView. LiveView's mission is to unlock the full potential of Earth observation data for humanity and life on Earth through AI. We are the global market leader in infrastructure monitoring and are bringing the power of satellite data analytics to other industries globally. Talk to us to find out how satellite data can benefit you and your company via podcast at live-eo.com.
Yeah, and do you guys already use ChatGPT for like internal processes? You're smiling for the listeners. He's smiling right now. So.
Definitely, yeah. No. We've been playing a lot with it, right? From obviously trying to, fully internally from stuff like coding, right? Copilot, these kind of tools, which I think is extremely exciting. To just kind of enhancing productivity through Slack and through summarizing meetings and all of that. So that's for sure. I think the interesting question will be like, how will it change how people interact with maps ultimately, right? How is the map interface going to change, or what kind of impact will it have on that? Because is it going to be, and I think some, I think Planet has recently made an announcement on that as well, or demonstrated some interesting tech. Can you just ask the questions to the map essentially, right? And you kind of get an answer to your questions instead of having to, look at different layers, run a bunch of like geo kind of processing in the browser or in QGIS or whatever, which is still like an expert tool.
Yeah.
Right. So I think this has a lot of promise to simplify this.
Yeah. No, we absolutely agree with that. I think like for me personally, at least, I think the way we interface with maps will definitely change, right? I don't think that in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, people would still click like radiator buttons to select something or provide like work with filters to manipulate maps in some extent. But I think that I at least personally, I need a two-dimensional landscape to look at, and this provides much more context than written text. So I think the interface how we interact with maps will definitely change, how most likely also how the maps will look like, but I think we still need maps in the end. But you've mentioned QGIS, and Daniel previously mentioned Google Maps. What are currently tools which are used by your customers, your potential users to solve the already existing problems which they have? So so what's the competitive landscape of yours?
That's a great question, actually. So I would say, and that's kind of like what we think is, so a lot of the customers we talk to actually do not really use maps in any kind of like significant way yet. A lot of it is still kind of more analytics in like tabular form, right? It's kind of just, for example, if you do due diligence for some, for kind of like a solar power, a photovoltaic power plant. Very often this is just done on in Excel. You look at a bunch of kind of like data sets that are coming in that maybe your investee has shared with you. Very rarely have we heard of like some, people looking at it on Google Earth, having a look at it in QGIS. But in this sector, I think it's still very, it's not really used, that like maps and geospatial data is just not really used, I would say, from what we've seen so far.
Yeah.
So I think it's more about actually introducing the map to that sector.
Yeah.
And then also winning people over, saying like, hey, look, it's not just, it's more than just saying, look, it looks good. You can have a look at it and see it, but actually it's getting some insights from it, right?
Yeah.
Through adding the proper layers. So this is kind of what we're still seeing the most at this point.
Yeah. And I would have a question to that, because obviously we have a similar kind of, obviously we sell to different customers than you do, but oftentimes we are also exposing end users for the first time to a geospatial interface. And so and the customer enablement plays a big role. I think like what we have is like our customers, we can drive to them. We can have a customer person fly out to them and to enable them to interact with our tools. And we hope that our tools are very easy to understand and have a great UI and UX, and we're working on it every day. But how are you supporting your users in the field? How do you encourage and support user uptake, especially of people maybe in very A, remote locations, or B, with a kind of different digital education? Yeah, how do you deal with that?
That's a great question. And to be honest, very similar to just what you just said. So very often it's flying out there, doing training sessions, sitting down with end users, going through it, like kind of, you know, how do you use the platform? And I think there is definitely this, the added challenge. I think to try to make things extremely user-friendly, which is a challenge in and on itself, right? To how do you simplify working with geospatial data sets on the map for somebody who hasn't maybe previously worked with that? So there's a lot of user research that goes into it to really just on usability, right? And actually there, I think there's some really cool new tools that are kind of like emerging. One thing that comes to mind, which I find really exciting, is Felt. I'm not sure if you've heard of it.
No.
But it's like a very much like, it's like a map. It's kind of like FigJam or Miro, where it's a tool you can draw on the map. You know, they can leave comments much more easily. So I think there are kind of people out there, and we count ourselves among them as well, just to kind of really try to make it as simple as possible to work with these maps. Having said that, at the end of the day, it's still all about staying with the customers on support calls, going there for workshops, and just spending as much time as you can with them and delivering kind of like this continuous support.
Yeah. One question Sven and I also for LiveYo are trying to answer or are thinking about a lot is our moats in the future, right? So how can we protect our technology? Let's say in 5 to 10 years, when all these things are getting easier and easier, right? You just mentioned Felt, like this application to interact with maps. And I would have a question to you, which I don't know if it's easy to answer, but is your special sauce now more in the combination of multiple data sets from ground and from space? Or do you see it more in the actionable end-user applications, like where you create this daily interaction?
I think it's the latter, really. I think it's really, I do think for us, it's really understanding these kind of the infrastructure investors, their pain points, and really getting under, kind of like getting deep into their workflows and trying to kind of build something they love and kind of like that makes their lives easier. Because there is a huge benefit, obviously, on kind of adding the right layers on top of each other or running the right processing. I think that's equally valuable, by the way. Mm-hmm. But I think our specialty really, I think, is in the latter.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I mean, we also see the big opportunity in this field, and we are always surprised that there's one platform to build these end-user applications, which is basically Esri. So are you like are you partnering with Esri, or can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, sure. No, we're not partnering with Esri. We know some people there, of course. We've been using the kind of quite a few people in our team have experience working with it.
Yeah.
At the time, they do offer the kind of a way to kind of like build geospatial applications. But like at the time when we looked into it, it didn't really match our use case and like what we had in mind specifically around this certain features that that we knew we wanted to build, which we knew would have been very hard to kind of like fit into the product offering of Esri for the web maps. Having said that, I've seen some really cool applications actually that were built with Esri. So it definitely gets you off the ground quicker.
Yeah.
But I think especially as you move away, not just from, also maybe move away from just pure map views, which we also find ourselves doing quite often actually, that it's not just here's the map and that's all you see all the time, but rather kind of like embedding it into kind of the a larger software. And I think that there's some limitations that I've seen in these with these kind of frameworks.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we see it the same. Like we are an Esri partner. We also integrate into Esri apps, but we also have our own applications, right? So, but it's interesting. In our industry, a lot of end users are using Esri. But maybe let's move a bit forward in the discussion, because you said one thing earlier in the discussion, that it's a big challenge enabling end users to bring their own data. So we're now not talking about remote sensing data, but the data from the field. Well, what are the challenges you have there? Like, is it more like people challenges, technological challenges, geospatial challenges?
I think it's the people challenges, and just kind of, again, it's that challenge of trying to kind of like bring it all together and getting some kind of like transparency. Because again, with infrastructure investors that we work with, there's a whole bunch of different actors, right? From the people who actually built the site, they have to report back. Then the infrastructure investors themselves have to kind of report back to their own investors. Then there's kind of reporting bodies, etc. And there's on-ground teams. So we see it as kind of like coordinating this. Or what we often see is that it's a coordination issue, really. There's like a lot of different people who kind of have to contribute kind of small pieces of information about the same project. And kind of ensuring that these people can like communicate with each other to kind of like request certain data sets that then also end up in the same place in the platform. I think this is the main challenge. So we don't so much see it in, say, the fact that they come around with giant geospatial data, or like that size of the data sets is, for example, an issue. I think it's really more about the fact that there's a ton of information spread across emails and sometimes WhatsApp chats and Excel sheets, and kind of like bringing this all together is kind of, that's, I think, one of the key challenges we're facing.
Yeah. No, exactly, because what you've mentioned that exactly also this shift from energy to a more broader impact investing, a broader view which you're taking. Generally, what we're seeing is obviously a shift, maybe a slow shift, slower than wanted, but we see a shift in behavior and investment behavior and also focus of the public eye. Vida Place has now been around for a little while. You've been in the sector for a little longer than that even. And so do you see really right now like a landslide shift in the interest for your types of solutions, and due to climate change and the fight against climate change, a quicker kind of sales speed, sales velocity, as the sales people would say?
I would say so, yes. That is definitely our impression. That's also what's motivating to us. I do think it's an important, it is at the top of, or the top, it is in the minds of a lot of like these investors who would previously not really have thought about it that much. So I think it all kind of comes together, right? There's obviously the more regulations that are coming in various sectors. At the same time, there's also, I think, very much a realization that if you invest into infrastructure, this is a very long time horizon, right? So climate risks are very real. This is not just like now something that, is nice to look at, but it doesn't really matter at the end of the day.
Yeah.
I think there's this assessment or this feeling that this is really something that needs to be that needs to be part of every due diligence, of every kind of like decision that is being made about whether or not to invest in a certain project. So my sense now is that this is definitely, it's still slow moving, because it's the financial system, it has a ton of actors in it. But I would say now, also like this year, I think there's definitely been, that there is a lot of activity on it. There's a lot of conferences out there, a lot of people asking about it. So, and we also see that with the interest in our product.
So you just said specifically this year, right? Did I hear that correctly?
Yeah, this year. Over the last 12 months, it went this way.
Nice. Yeah, because, the company is there since 2018, right? So it's now already 5 years.
Yeah, exactly.
We see the same trend also now with macroeconomics. And we hear it also from our investors and others that, the next big trends are energy, AI, climate change. So it's, and sustainability, right? So that's
Yeah.
Your company is in the sweet spot, as I live here is too.
We hope so. Yeah.
Just saying. let's talk a bit about the organization, because it's in the sweet spot, and you also raised some venture capital. Correct me if I'm wrong, but Crunchbase had 1.7 million euros so far. So congrats to that.
Okay, and you look confused.
Actually, that is not. It's funny that because we haven't had a commercial kind of like we haven't had a venture capital round.
Interesting.
So, it's interesting that that's on Crunchbase. Yeah, we should check that.
But
we've been.
Mm-hmm. So how is the company funded?
So yeah, so initially it started again with this. All got kickstarted by this ESA grant, some other grant money that we got. And at this point, actually, we're also very, very strongly revenue funded. Actually, we are currently fundraising, but a lot of our kind of like money is still coming from existing projects and clients, which also, especially in this climate, obviously is a strong selling point.
It's another point which is backing you. And you already have 38 employees based on LinkedIn. Is that true?
So we are at 28.
28.
I'm not sure if LinkedIn sometimes. I think there's a Vita, some other company that's called Vita. So maybe that's bumping up the numbers. I think we're at, correctly, I think it's 27 or 28 people. Yeah.
But it's very impressive. We are also in this ecosystem for a while. And you are now hitting a size of a company where purely based on revenue, you don't see this very often, right? So a lot plateauing at 10 employees or something like this, even with venture capital, mm-hmm. what we have seen.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the round is announced that you want to fundraise I'm sure there are some investors in the audience. So what are you looking for?
Yeah, definitely. So we're currently raising a seed round. And that's Tobias, our CEO, is very busy on that, obviously, and that we want to close, in over the next quarters, essentially.
Nice.
So we're actively looking for that.
Cool. So you should definitely reach out to Philip. Obviously, you find him on LinkedIn. And if that's not successful, reach out to Daniel and myself, and we will make the intro. But that sounds super cool. I think
awesome.
But really, like, super impressive that you've been bootstrapped to that size. It's incredible. Really cool. Before we end the podcast, I would have still one Earth observation question, I think, which we forgot to ask, which is,
Sure. You've
mentioned that you haven't been working with so much very high resolution satellite data, and commercial satellite data, it seems. What are the problems for you to work with this type of data set? Is it the access? Is it the price? Is it the companies and the way they are working?
Mm-hmm. So, we have been working with some of the first of all, it's really exciting kind of like to see the new, especially kind of like the new crop of companies coming out, who are offering that, right? And we've been working quite a bit with Up42. I think you've had the CEO on the podcast, one of those days as well. We've been, trying, Sci-Fi, I think it was just launched recently. I think it's really cool that like there's more and more of these companies that also offer more permissive licensing, yep. because definitely the licensing, especially of the raw image, has definitely been an issue, yep. because a lot of our customers, very often, again, it kind of goes back to also the where our end users are at, right? Very often, just an image is awesome to look at, right? Especially if you're also like looking at infrastructure, just having it there for the end user to see. Is often equally as important as kind of showing the derivative or kind of like the derived analytics that you can do on top of it. So a lot of the platforms still don't really allow for this, or it's kind of hairy, or it's at least not very clear what exactly you have to do. So you have to be some sort of like reseller. So that is definitely for a company at our stage, that is kind of a deal breaker, because it's just too much of a headache really to kind of like get into it. Another thing is, but what used to be availability of just coverage. Again, when this is not so much an issue now, because we now have a lot of kind of locations, assets in the developed world. But if you look at more remote areas, obviously it's very hard to get up to date VHR imagery in the catalogs, and then you have to do tasking, and that it gets much more expensive very quickly. But also there, actually, I do see that I think just with new constellations coming online, I imagine this will be much, much easier in the future, much cheaper as well to kind of say task a satellite at like affordable prices. So I'm having my hopes up that this is going to change very soon. And then we'll definitely see how we put this kind of like properly into production. Because again, today we kind of do it every now and then buying VHR imagery, but we really would love to see this as kind of like a full kind of integrated part of our offering.
Yeah, that sounds good. And I just want to tell for the listeners to repeat what you said regarding the licenses, because we also see this and we're also working on this. And some operators are very open now, but just imagine you pay a lot of money for a satellite task somewhere, and the satellites are not 100% utilized there, so their capacity is not fully utilized. At the end, you can do your analytics on top, which you can then ship to the customer, but you are not allowed to show the image which you did the analytics on top of without paying a significant amount on top. It's not just a few percent, it's actually a significant amount just to show the image you did derive everything on top of already. So this is somehow like a thing, like Sven and I think you won't see in other industries. Like this is so far away from the end user. Of course, everyone who gets analytics wants to also look at the stuff to validate it, like most of the people are doing this. So this is just so far away from the end users. And I'm happy, like companies like Umbra, like we also had Joe Morrison on the podcast, they're completely changing the game for radar, for SAR imagery and so on. And this is really something which has to change. And just hearing it from you that this is actually the blocker for you, that you can't adopt to this, is ridiculous, right? So,
exactly.
So they either like to do no money with you than having better licensing. And this is also when you look into the entire industry, like the growth for, you know, the governmental customers, yeah, whatever they pay, that's just how it is. And they are, like these companies always say, there is no commercial market, or the commercial market is slow and so on. Like I'm talking about the dinosaurs, but at the end, it's these things which are limiting the adoption. But I'm happy. So like we have a lot of discussions with operators, et cetera, around this, but it's just a matter of time, because there are new players out there, the new kids on the block, which come with a different license model. And then the old guys with the awesome satellites, they will also change. They have to change, right?
So,
I share that assessment for sure. And I think it just opening that up, right? To kind of, again, like you can kind of talk to, as you mentioned, like you can talk to some of these operators and you might kind of get, you know, after many emails and stuff, you can might reach an agreement that you can kind of like do it. But what it really does is it closes the door to people who are just in passing looking at imagery and actually might build an awesome product with it that had nothing to do previously with satellite imagery. And you're kind of like closing that door, because for these, it's like they see it and it's a turn off, right? You're just not going to kind of further investigate it. So, but yeah, I share your assessment. I'm sure this is going to change very soon, thanks to these kind of like new players and new kids on the block.
Yeah, I think in the past, the Earth observation industry has stood in themselves in the way, or I think you could even say that for the entire geospatial industry. But this is changing thanks to companies like VidaPlace, and we at LiveU will try to play our role as well. Hey, Philip, thank you very much for spending so much time with us. Before we end the podcast, we have one final question, which is, who should we have on the podcast next time?
Yeah, sure. So one person I can recommend is Bruno Sanchez. So he's, I think he was previously way back at Mapbox, at one of the, I think, the founding team. He's been kind of like all over the industry. He's been part of an accelerator program. He's been kind of like our mentor for many, many years now. And he's just a really nice guy to talk to with a lot of insights, also about like where the industry as a whole is going, especially also with like recent developments in AI. So I think this could be a really good person to talk to next.
Super cool. Super. Now, we obviously would love to get an intro there, but this sounds really exciting, and definitely we're going to put him on top of our list for the next upcoming episodes. But first of all, Philip, I think it was a pleasure. We've learned a lot about VidaPlace, and also generally a lot about how geospatial data is being used in international development and development aid, and how can we support also the green transition of everyone here on the surface of the Earth. Well, also thanks to the listeners, and where can people follow you, Philip?
So yeah, first of all, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure. You can obviously follow us, especially also company update, obviously on LinkedIn. So you'll find us there at vida.place. We're on Twitter under the same handle as well. And yeah, this is kind of like where we post most of our updates.
Excellent. Cool. Then I hope every listener does exactly that. Please also make sure to follow NewSpace Vision at all the outlets on social media, and make sure to tune in next time when we produce and release another NewSpace Vision episode. Thank you very much.
Have a sunny day, guys.
Thank you.
All right, lift off, and the clock is started.
Roger, the angle has landed.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade.